It's the pilot episode of Reverse Rec Radio, broadcasting live from a room in Baker Street. This is Andy Ryan.
And Toby Chad.
Welcome to the podcast with all the penetration of Nathan Horritt on a hot day in Bangalore.
The Lord of the Isles winning runs, India win the best match, the Farmers win.
So early this morning, we have India wrapping up a 2-0 series victory.
Which I think they never looked like losing from the very beginning of the first test, actually. Even though some of the batting was sketchy when you have someone like Tendulkar who is arguably playing as well as he ever has.
It was a strange one though, because you said they never looked like losing, but actually, you look at it blow by blow this series, and it was close throughout. We had 10 days of extremely close cricket, extremely well competed and tightly contested cricket.
It was close, but Australia never looked like having a real killer blow. And in essence, that's what India had, particularly at the end of the second test when their spinners came on and reduced Australia pretty quickly, 7 wickets down.
But does this Indian team, does it look like a world number one team? Are we dealing with a side that you think, has it got the fear factor that previous world number one sides have had?
Being a world number one, I suppose, depends on what the other teams in the world are doing. And actually what this series, I think, has been quite a good illustration of is that, you know, everyone goes on about Australia being a team in decline, and actually it gets a bit boring. After a while, people talking about that all the time, but I think, you know, they are, and I don't think, actually, that there's a team that's better equipped than India simply because they have a very good batting lineup, an old batting lineup. But
are we sort of saying they're slightly number one by default here? They're number one of a pile that's maybe not as strong as it's been.
Yeah, but that doesn't stop them being number one. I don't think India are sort of over the hill, actually. I think, you know, yes, actually.
Well, over the hill, we have an Indian team. They turn to Sachin Tendulkar, who appears to have pretty much carried them through this series. Big score in their first innings here in Bangalore. I mean, is this a side that Tendulkar moves on? I reckon maybe a year and a half max, Tendulkar looks to move on. I mean, are we going to see them cope without him?
Well, I would dispute for a start whether he's going to move on in a year and a half. He's playing as well as he ever was. It's not as if he's getting injured every 5 minutes. And actually, I think one of the interesting things about Tendulkar in this series is that he's just such a mature, such a wise cricketer that he always plays the right role. So you look at him from the early 2000s and he's going out and, you know, in these matches against Australia, hitting really quick in a pretty big hundreds.
I think it's sort of, you have to look at and you think the next generation is coming through. And I suppose I would say, if you're being positive about the best thing India take from this series, 100 from Murali Vijay, good inning effort from Suresh Raina, good effort from Pujara as well. You've got young batsmen stepping up here and scoring runs. You'd still question, though, you take Tendulkar out of the equation, you question, have you got a side that can sustain that sort of world number one rank?
No, you don't, but you do have a side in which, it's a side in transition, of course it is. And you look at, you know, Laxman, for instance, and it's quite interesting. It's quite interesting that Pujara is only in because Laxman is. That's quite an interesting dynamic in itself. But I don't think it's a bad thing. It's a side of transition, and actually having someone like Tendulkar, and actually having someone like Dhoni as a captain means that it's quite easy for young players to come in and actually to sort of be ushered through.
Yeah. So I mean, I think the future, it's really the focus needs to be on what these young players are doing rather than what Tendulkar's achieving. I mean, what's interesting with someone like Murali Vijay is you've got someone who's basically come to the game who's made his impression certainly via 2020. He comes in, makes 139 off 310 balls, a patient innings. You know, he's not gone out there necessarily and looked to play. He's shown the ability to hang around. And I think what's encouraging is you've got this idea that players play 2020 and can't adapt to the test format. And actually, you've got players like Vijay, players like Raina, who are turning up and actually showing that. And I suppose, if we're being fair, it's not as if there's a massive, in terms of replacing Australia's older guard, there's maybe not a huge number of youngsters knocking on the door there, if we're going to ask the same question of them.
But then again, with Australia, you have this perennial situation where, and it was especially the case throughout the late 90s and early 2000s, where they just had such a strong team that actually when someone did retire, you get someone so exceptional, you know, coming in and coming in and playing straight away. We'd just been kept out of the team by a Ponting or a Wall or a Warm or something like that. And Tim Payne, I think, is a very, very good prospect.
If we sticking on the Australians, the person who seemed ever present in his sort of mediocrity throughout the series did seem to be Nathan Horowitz. I mean, I wonder if the criticism has been a touch harsh. You come to India, you're playing some of the best spinners, the best players of spin in the world game, some such experienced players. It seems unreasonable to expect Horowitz to really have ever had success here, to ever achieve anything. And this, the aggression that's sort of being targeted by him, the press and the media, seems perhaps a touch harsh.
And maybe Warne hit the nail on the head in his Twitter outburst about it being Ponting's field that was wrong rather than.
It was quite touching in a way to see Warne coming to the defence of, well, someone who you could describe very loosely as his heir. But
I don't think he's any danger from Horowitz in terms of the legacy
of Raps. Yeah.
But what I did wonder was whether, and purely from reading Warne's Twitter outburst, where he talks about a field that's very much there's a leg slip and a short leg and a long on and a long off and a deep point, and that's a very attacking field to have for an off swinger, because as soon as he ever pitches, it's just blown straight away.
Well,
through the covers, and I wonder whether there's been a little bit of kind of misinterpretation of what Harris is, because I think he's very, very good as a fairly defensive spinner, a holding spinner, which Warne wasn't, and I wonder whether the Australians are actually suffering a bit of a hangover from Warne in the sense that
I felt some sympathy for him in the first test where he was given such a role, there were so many overs put on his back, and yet he simply wasn't. He eventually picked up a wicket when Zaheer Khan went for a crazy, crazy blowing top. He never looked like troubling any of the major Indian top order, and perhaps, you know, Shane Warne himself had real issues succeeding in India. I mean, looking ahead to the Ashes, and you can't not but look to the head of the Ashes, it's the last time, well, it's the major test Australia have gone through for the Ashes. I mean, you can't help thinking on the subject of Horowitz, he is going to be, every England batsman is going to be seeing him as the easy runs, him as the easy, yeah, him as the soft target.
And I think it depends, as does the Ashes as a whole, so much on how Ponting plays it as a captain. And I think, you know, how he decides to use Horowitz is so important, just as...
But the only thing that occasionally surprises me, and it does occasionally, when you go back and look at these old series and actually look at the figures, is you see that Horowitz had a very decent time in England in 2009. For a guy who, again, much has been in India, repeatedly berated. I mean, there's got to be an opportunity chance here that some of the England batsmen, they see someone like Horowitz. You wonder, did they underrate him in 2009? I wonder if there's not the same risk they do that in 2010. They go after him on these Australian pitches, and they maybe don't have the success they expect. I mean, it's his home environment. It's where he's built his career. It's where it's perhaps slightly relative. He's had what success he's had.
Well, I suspect that the whole dynamic of the Ashes, the 2010-11 Ashes, would be very different from the 2009 Ashes, because you're talking about the Australia-India series and all the sessions being very well balanced, but if you look at the 2009 Ashes, you know, literally every year, well, not literally, but very nearly every session, you could say was owned by someone, and, you know, there are just these catastrophic collapses and these, you know, and blitzing innings all over the place.
But I'm thinking, if you look ahead to the Ashes, then it's instinctive, you're like, Australia got beaten, especially in the first test. They've suffered one of those really painful defeats. They've had the game theirs, it was theirs to win, and they've lost it. And in terms of, you look ahead at this England fan, and I mean, the one thing, like, the positive I take, is that you think, that's the kind of test that a real Australian team in its prime would never have let get away. You know, Laxman and Sharma batting the way they did. Laxman, you know, incapable of running, batting the way he did. And you'd think an Australian team in its prime wouldn't get away. The only thing you would say, it's a bowling attack that I think is probably more useful than people give it credit for. I would, as an English batsman, I would not have liked watching Mitchell Johnson in the first test especially. Good aggression, good pace.
And when was the last time that the English batsman, I suppose, faced real out-and-out pace? Because it certainly wasn't over the summer. The Pakistani bowlers, wonderful though they were not the kind of bowlers that England were going to face in Australia.
The kind of warm-up they've had against Pakistan, obviously you put the spot fixing side and all these things aside, you've been facing bowlers who swing the ball, actually facing bowlers who are more, I mean, with respect, I mean, Johnson, Huddinghouse both do swing the ball, but that are perhaps more about out-and-out aggression, especially in Johnson's case, is going to be a challenge. And you think back to England facing Morkel and Steyn, especially towards the end of that series, and they did have issues, and you just wonder how well prepared perhaps they are in some ways.
And I suppose, and you know, that sense of preparation very much goes back to 2006, the last time England tried to defend the Ashes down under, and we wonder whether it's all part of some great big cycling.
Well, there's a good optimism in there at the moment. You basically, I mean, I can't help feeling a little bit different towards this trip as I've done to previous ones. You really sense that England side's got a fantastic chance of going there and nicking something. But you do wonder if there might be a bit of deja vu with 2006, a sort of sense of, oh, we won it here, can't we win it here? And maybe we do just need to be aware of quite how hard it is to go there.
But I think there's a very different setup now. I think Andy Carr is a very pragmatic coach. And I think that the sort of, after the Ashes in 2005, you know, the open top bus ride through Trafalgar Square and the pics of Freddie Flintoff completely pestered Downing Street the morning afterwards.
We went low key this time.
But then making Flintoff captain, I mean, it was sort of trying to make some kind of fairy tale out of the whole thing. But I think now it's much more hard made. It's much more Paul Collingwood rather than Freddie Flintoff in the character of the whole setup.
Yeah, I think you can't get away from the fact, I think, that even though there's still this sort of feeling, it's a tough place to go. It just isn't the same team. I mean, we went over in 2006 against a side, still had McGrath, still had Ward, and I think perhaps you just can't get away from that. So I think, let's say, right to be optimistic, right to maybe be a bit excited. I do wonder, though, if you look at the England bowling attack, and this was probably my concern, you look at Mitchell Johnson, is there anyone who can do play quite that role at the moment in the current England side? You know, you worry a little bit about, it's very easy even now to think of Jimmy Anderson, Stuart Broad, throwing the toys out of the pram, sulking, losing it a little bit in those conditions.
Which is why it might be, why Steve Finn in a sense might be the perfect replacement.
But I mean, the experience is an issue, isn't it?
The experience is an issue, absolutely. But the kind of, maybe this is entirely the wrong way to look at it, but the kind of boiling chops that he brings to the whole proceedings is actually
so I'm thinking that Steve Finn's inexperienced boyish optimism is carrying him through a five-test match.
They haven't made the England coach yet, but maybe they will on the back.
He certainly. You do wonder the role he will play seems more crucial. The past evidence. I mean, and I hate to tell him because I think he's a fantastic bowler when things are going well. But Jimmy Anderson. Isn't one for knuckling down, I would argue. When conditions are against him, when a good batting lineup is on top of him, in good batting conditions, he tends to go
so,
anywhere.
So you think we need a Hoggard?
My concern is that I don't think it's that difficult to imagine a situation where Anderson and Broad don't give up, but are struggling. Finn is struggling, maybe justifiably. He's new to it, it's a new occasion. And suddenly England find themselves very, very short. And I think the pressure on Graham Swann already is unbelievable, is immense. I mean, if you read some of the stuff that's been written, the expectation seems to be that Swann will win this for England. Swann's the defining factor. And I think you know, inevitably, Swan didn't have, we talked about Horrocks having a good Ashes in 2009, Swan had a pretty average Ashes in 2009, especially by the high standards he set since. And yet, you know, they might be a little expecting a little bit too much from him.
But then again, you always, I suppose the acid test is always, it's 350 for two at, you know, the Adelaide Oval or wherever with Ponting going along and 150 off 170 balls, what do you do? But I think actually that England have got a pretty good second string bowling attack in the form of Collingwood and, well, even though he's not second string, but Swan is a middle overs bowler, is actually very good. He's very clever at being able to.
It's interesting, the role the second string will play, because the Aussies themselves have got Clark and North, who you expect will take a lot of overs, especially if Horrocks has issues, fails to trouble England, and comes under attack. You expect that they'll take a lot of overs. I mean, England's stretching to don't necessarily have someone there. You know, KP has done that role in the past. You know, someone there as a backup spinner to Swan. It'll be interesting.
But do you think for Australia there's an argument for actually dropping Horrocks and having just Clark and North as the spinner attack?
You wonder, after a series which has been so unsuccessful, it won't happen. Horrocks will play in that first test. But you do wonder if there isn't a case for that. I mean, does Horrocks offer anything substantially more than North or Clark? I mean, he rolls slightly better, but is it worth a place? Is it worth an extra spot in the team? I think it's fairly questionable.
I would disagree entirely and say that you would have to play with him every test, or at least you'd have to play with some form of front-end spinner, simply because if you play with Clark and North, there's invariably going to be a four ball in there. And particularly if you want someone holding up an end against, you know, Pilkinghouse and Johnson and toiling away. You want them to be your real strike bowlers, and they can't be if ones are leaking at the other end when batsmen come to face Pilkinghouse.
I think however you look at it, Horrocks is going to be key, and whether England successfully target him or whether he can repeat this trick of 2009 where he was underrated, not taken seriously, and he had a great series. Unbelievable though it sounds, I think Nathan Horrocks' performances will be absolutely decisive in where the Ashes end up this summer. I mean, if he matches Graham Swan, then I think England do have problems, because I think in the seam department, they don't have the superiority over Australia that maybe we thought. South Africa for a 2020 series, and we actually, from a series that, I mean, it's hardly looked like a marquee fixture in the international calendar, actually was fairly lively couple of 2020s.
And does it make you optimistic I've
always had a massive soft spot for Zimbabwe, and I don't think at the moment, I don't think any cricket fan couldn't help to feel for a country that's obviously been through a huge amount. Cricketing-wise, it has been a mess. You know, endless players have kicked out, lost from the system. And, you know, they went there. They really batted seriously without fear. It was interesting. You know, it was fun to watch some of those young players particularly just go for it, play their shots.
But batting seriously without fear and young players playing their shots isn't a great recipe or advert for a stable... if you look at how Bangladesh were in every few years, you know 2020 and one day success.
So we don't get carried away too quickly, but you can say, I think, I'm shocked, to be honest, that given the issues, they are that's affected the game, they are competing at this level so quickly.
And scoring 180 on.
Yeah, I mean, and I think we're looking at the South African side that brought a pretty strong side. It was a pretty strong lineup, and you've got players in the Zimbabwe side, players like Brendan Taylor in particular, Chipapa, who played some really exciting innings. You just wonder. I definitely take the point. The 2020 game, I think, it's a great leveler. Like we've now got to say, Zimbabwe look like a side that can compete with most of the top sides in the international arena. Whether what this means in terms of Test cricket, I'll accept. Is
I think you're wrong on that, because you're saying that they can compete, but scoring 180 in, you know, they can score runs. Yes.
Yeah.
They can throw the bat around and score runs, but the fact is that they can't score runs and then win matches on the back. That's exactly the problem that Bangladesh.
And I think so if we take a backward step and we say what you would think was like tapping the series, I think you would see a comfortable South Africa hammering. And I think what represents success for Zimbabwe here is they haven't let them do that. On home turf, they've gone there and got a result. I think it's a very fair point to say it means nothing unless you can go out and defend these totals. And their bowlers were heavily, heavily punished. But we go to India next year, pitches there will be a lot more favourable to the spinners than they've had in South Africa.
And they are very spin-based.
They look to defend their totals through a mainly spin-based attack. So I think an interesting prospect. We're not going to get too carried away and not talk about dark horses yet, maybe, for the next year's World Cup. I think they'll cause, bold prediction, they'll cause at least a couple of the big size problems there.
And actually, their reliance on the spinners is actually quite interesting, because obviously 2020 is a format that's fairly inimical to spinners. And even though Dan Overtoury is coming and he's sort of made 2020 and one day cricket his own, because he's so good, he sort of made it look a bit too easy, really. And well, I don't think we should be, even though in one of the one days there were three of the Zimbabwean batsmen going for over 11 and over. I don't think that's necessarily
a
bad thing.
Yeah, and they. I mean, the other issue, they are still young, and there is still the opportunity, certainly for development there. And the opportunity for them, they play more of these big games in South Africa and against the other big sides, and we'll see where they go. Some progress in trying to get included as an Olympic sport needs to make more of a push to get into these events. Now, my feeling, although this might be massively anathema to a lot of people, this idea that maybe football and rugby are making the effort, they're getting the publicity, they're getting the profile of this. Maybe cricket, they follow the lead of these sports. It slightly pains me to say that, but you look at the coverage football in the Olympics gets, and maybe cricket needs to try and get in on that.
But I think that it's a fairly misleading thing to say, because I think football gets a lot of coverage because it already has a lot of coverage. And if you look at some of the less sports, if you look at tennis, for instance, you have to go to probably Sky Sports Channel 137 before you get the
final.
And actually, there's this question of quality as well, that if you are putting something onto a global stage and saying, you know, this is cricket and this is what cricket is to new audiences, that actually I think a lot of teams wouldn't. I mean, there's so much cricket in the international calendar already.
I could definitely take the point. We've got an overload and overcrowded schedule as it is. If, I know, again, feeling slightly uncomfortable saying this, but you look at the football example and you see that within football in the Olympics, it's openly accepted, it's not the same level, it's not the same quality. We've got youth teams that are basically set there. It's still popular, it's still watched. And you wonder, I mean, does it get to a stage where if you've got an Olympics, I know we don't have this at the moment, but if you've got an Olympics where all the major sports are represented, does it start to look slightly odd almost if cricket's not there?
No, it doesn't, because football has the great luxury, as do actually most sports, football, rugby, have the great luxury of having a World Cup. And if I were to ask you at any point, who are the world champions, you would be able to tell me straight away. Cricket, much to its benefit, but also it's also something that is very dangerous for the game. It doesn't have that element at all, because there are so many different elements. There's Test cricket, there's 2020 cricket, there's one day.
Yeah.
And the problem is that I think is that if you bring in even more formats, I mean the idea of cricket, even as it stands at the moment, is a very difficult one, because you know when you say cricket, what kind of cricket are you talking about? And the problem is that actually these different forms of the game sort of start cannibalising one another, you know, audiences are taken away from Test cricket to go to 2020 cricket, and would that be the same with Olympic cricket as well, that, you know, audiences were going there rather than to the Test rounds?
I think the point of what a gold medal for cricket would actually mean is quite a fair one. Like, we certainly wouldn't be talking about the world champions necessarily. I think, aside from anything, I think this is an issue that's going to come back and is going to be more relevant. I don't think it's maybe something that's going to be necessarily addressed in the next couple of years, but but I think I don't think it's going to get go away. I think, in particular, the ICC are aware and showing that they are desperate to spread the game in any way possible. And I think the Olympics is going to come up. I mean, following on from this idea, and this was the second issue, and the one that kind of unavoidably really has come up in the last couple of days, this idea of a Test Championship. Thoughts?
No. Danger. flashing.
No danger, danger.
Is my initial thought. I think, again, going back to my idea of sort of just the confusion that reigns in cricket at the moment, and I just can't see it as being anything more than completely arbitrary.
I mean, if we didn't have a dying laptop in front of us, I would like to check a couple more of the details on this, but my feeling is this. Okay, if the Test game works as it should, and you're a proper series, well-competed, series that people care about and like, who is world number one? And this idea of a Test Championship should be irrelevant, shouldn't be necessary. I don't see, if the basics are right, then I don't think necessarily this game isn't going to solve the problem. This one-off sort of battle isn't going to solve the problem. The problem's there. For me, the scheduling is where we need to have the fight here, isn't it? Where we need to have the argument here. I mean, we have an India-Australia series here, a fantastic series. We definitely dispute the length, which I think is a real shame.
But it's better than it would have been, because it wasn't actually going
to
be...
Good to have it, rather than not have it at all, certainly. And I mean, it's a fantastic sign to see India taking it on. But at the same time, you get the feeling that the series has almost been squeezed into the schedule. I mean, what we need is these big series, given their part, given their role, listened to and taken seriously, I think.
Yeah.
But do you reckon this is going to last, is the other thing? I mean, do you think this is one of these kind of one-off, you know, someone at the ICC has sat down and had, I don't know what you call it now, sort of a thought shower, a brainstorm.
No brainstorms anymore.
Yeah, no brainstorms, yeah.
I think it probably is, and we're always getting these crazy ideas coming through from the ICC. We seem to become day by day more and more disconnected, actually, from what cricketism means. But, I mean, I think part of the problem about having a Test World Championship is simply that, without trying to be sort of too philosophical about the whole thing, is that one of the beauties about Test cricket is that it's not particularly it's a statistician's heaven, and that's why Crick Info is the biggest single sports website in the world. But it's also it's not just about the objective part of it, and it's not about being able to say we're the best team in the world. It's about those individual.
It's an interesting question: how much the extent to which people care about the rankings? I mean, they do. In that India, I think it's been a huge issue in the revival of the game, that the fact that they're number one, but it's certainly not the major issue. I mean, I think in terms of precisely how the rankings work, so, you know, there's a lot of confusion there and a lot of, sort of disorder there.
But you say that there's been a huge issue in this revival them being number one. How so?
Well, I mean, I think we would not have had this series, I don't think, unless we had a number one Indian side. I think it's a bizarre state the game's in. We've got a situation where the fact of the necessity of Indian success for the future of the Test game seems key. Unless India's winning and successful in Test matches, I think India will... We're not going to see them committing to Test matches.
But winning and being successful in Test matches isn't the same as winning this Test...
I'm not entirely sure what is this being called. Is it a Test World Cup?
It's a four-year cycle, isn't it, with playoffs and a final.
Yeah. I mean, the other final issue I do think is worth raising here, you are going to see further and further, I think, this sort of two-tier split-off. I mean, let's be very honest at the moment, you know, West Indies, New Zealand, countries that are already struggling, the games there are in real issue. I mean, they're not going to play a role in this final playoff system. They're going to feel more and more and be treated more and more as sort of B-tier nations.
And actually, it's going to mean that along with these plans for the Test World Cup or whatever it's being called, are thoughts about downscaling the 50-over World Cup.
Adding
teams to the 2020 World Cup.
Yeah.
And actually, the message that sends out, particularly going back to the Olympic thing, if the Olympic thing comes in, is that actually, if you're a small team, that you're automatically going to be playing the shorter form of the game. Which, in a sense, is true, because it does take...
The message in all, I think, I would say, great to see them reducing the 50-over World Cup. This Test playoff is not... I don't think anyone would see it as the magic recipe that we'd be looking for in the Test game.
There's something more profound going on.
There's something more serious going on. Okay, thank you for putting up and successfully getting through the pilot episode of Reverse Rep Radio. We will be back on air in 2 weeks' time. Thank you very much.